Hey, this is Glenn Thrush with Politico's Off Message podcast here in New Hampshire. Jeb Bush is an interesting guy, and he's in an interesting situation. Started off this campaign as being the Republican frontrunner, had all the money in the world, looked to be unbeatable, and then everything fell apart. I took a bus ride with him on the way from Manchester to Concord on Saturday, and he reflected on his campaign. I thought it was a really interesting conversation because it's really boiled down to three things. First, he wants to win, obviously. Secondly, he really, really wants to take out Marco Rubio. And thirdly, and kind of perhaps in contradiction to the first two, he wants to change the process, make it more rational, make it more meaningful for what the presidency is. And probably the most interesting moment for me in the entire podcast was when he talked about his brother, George W. Bush. He was more passionate, in my mind, in defending his brother's presidency than he was in defending himself against Donald Trump's attack. So here is a 35-minute interview I think you'll find very interesting with former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. So hi, Governor. Good to see you.
Thanks, Glenn. Thanks for joining the bus.
Yeah, we are in the back of a bus, I should say, pulling out of a parking lot of St. Anselm's, and we are in, how would you describe this, a slush bucket?
It is. Looks like it stopped snowing, but now it's going to be pretty nasty to be walking in it, which is going to hurt our 100 volunteers that we were counting on going door to door.
Really? So it's going to be a pain in the neck.
We'll do it, though.
So what we were just talking about before we started was, I've been watching you in the debates. First of all, when I look at you up on stage, to some extent, and you started off the campaign, if I'm not mistaken, I may be misquoting you, but you were talking about self-awareness. I think you used that term in one of your first either interviews or during your announcement about who you were and what you wanted to do. One of the interesting things watching you on stage in some of these debates is not only hearing what you're saying, but watching you observe this spectacle. So I guess my first question to you is, what is it like being up there?
Well, first of all, it's not a debate. It's a performance, and it's a chance to spin it positively. It's a chance for you to say what you want to say to millions of people that you otherwise wouldn't be able to speak to.
Right.
So it's a huge opportunity, but it's not a debate. A debate would allow for a dialogue back and forth. And in some cases, you want to avoid having a debate. You want to be able to directly communicate your point. Answer the question as fast as you can and move on. But people say some crazy things on the debate stage. Maybe you're catching me when I have a facial expression saying, he just said that. That's interesting, you know. Because I do think there is, it's different when you run for president, or it should be different
right.
when you run for president. When you're running for the United States Senate, you're part of a collective body. You'd be one of 100. You have the shield of the rules and kind of the culture of the Senate. When you're running for president, your words have consequences before you're elected. People watch this, what you say.
But it doesn't seem to have that same level of consequence. I mean, when you're sitting up there and you're hearing Trump say the things that he's saying, it's almost as if, you know, during one of your debates, I tweeted that, you know, you're like a Shakespearean character wandering through a sitcom. Sometimes it just seems like you have a different level of gravity. And I think Kasich and Rubio to some extent do as well. I mean, it's the seriousness that seems to be different.
It is, but I'm saying that the rest of the world does take, these words have consequences.
Right.
So when you say something to appeal to people's gut, their anger, their angst, you're also saying it to the rest of the world. And it sends a signal of a lack of seriousness to our country. If you love this country and you want to be president of the United States, your words have consequences. So I don't consider it constraining at all.
Right.
To be serious about the pursuit. I just think it's the right way to do it. Because if you get elected,
right.
What are you going to do? All the stuff that you said before doesn't matter. Of course it matters. It sends a sign of significant weakness if all this was just a game. The great challenge for the next president is to restore trust.
Right. But the paradox is you're not being rewarded for the very thing that you personally regard as most presidential, which is circumspection and taking the process seriously. I'm not saying, you know, I don't mean that writ large, but I mean
it's early in the sense that the other element of this is the immediate gratification of all this. It's got to be, you know, everybody that observes this, you know, is focused on the here and now. Well, this is a long-haul process. Public sentiment, how people feel, will change. It always does. And if you stick to who you are and believe what you believe and persuade people over time, and you're consistent, you're not in the witness protection program every time the going gets tough, the simple fact is you can win the day. And I'm in it for the long haul.
Now, you obviously were very successful in Florida. This has been, you know, I don't think I'm breaking news here, it's been something of a grind at times. What have you found out about yourself that you didn't know before you started all this?
Not much. I have, you know, I am who I am. I haven't changed. I've enjoyed the process. I don't read all of the pundit stuff. I don't read the process stuff.
What do you do? I mean, like, I read briefing stuff.
I'll read the sports page. I'll read what's going on in the world. I'll read news.
What kind of stuff? Like today, for instance, there's a
today,
lot.
Today,
yeah.
The haven't read much today, but I read the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. I read the Manchester Union Leader. So I did read the articles, because most of the paper now is like the entire, you know, sport. Everything is consumed by this primary. I'm just curious to know how they cover the six different articles of six different presidential candidates in their market. So I did read that. But I don't read who's winning, who's losing, what do they have to do, unnamed pundits, unnamed fundraisers. Why would I do that?
It would drive you nuts.
Yeah. I mean, apart from that, it's not the exact same group of people will say something exactly different next week. I might as well just wait for next week.
So what gets you agitated about the process? Like what, I mean, like...
I got a pretty even keel about it. I work really hard, and I enjoy... I'll tell you what I like. I like the town hall meetings.
Tell me why.
Because people ask real questions, and you can share your empathy for the plight people are in. Or you can show your humor.
Right.
Or you can show the depth of understanding of a particular policy issue. Because people come... Some of them come... You know, like the first question I got in New Hampshire was politics and pie in Concord.
Right.
And this lady was about ready to burst. Her head was about ready to explode. So I asked her first in case there was, you know, I was in the splatter zone there. And she said, I'm worried about EMPs. Well, are you? And I had just read, back to reading, I had just read an article about electromagnetic pulse.
Right.
And the challenge that it could have. It could be a solar flare or it could be a
to
provocative
knock out the
act.
Whole, to knock out, the,
knock
whole
out
grid.
The grid.
Yep.
It's scary as crap. I mean, it's like, yeah. it's one yeah. of the scariest things that could happen.
Right.
It's something that I had no knowledge of. I'd read this article the week before. And so I was fluent on the subject. It shocked her because it was designed to make me look stupid, which is fun. I mean, the fact that, it was pure luck that I got through it. But the town hall meetings range from people that are deeply concerned about the future of the country, concerned about their plight. Last week, a lady told me, with good humor, her daughter was getting married. She was so excited about it. That's the good news. The bad news is the fiance and her daughter are getting an engineering degree and a PhD in physical therapy, and the total debt by the end of this semester will be $260,000, and they're going to have to live with her.
Right.
And people chuckled, but she wasn't...
It wasn't funny to her.
No, yeah. It wasn't funny because I don't think she... I think she correctly sensed that there was not going to be a way for them to get out from under $260,000 of recourse debt. And they're going to live with her, which she didn't mind because she loves her daughter,
right.
She said. But... So I asked her, and it was clear, the colleges never really said how much it ultimately was going to cost. The colleges never guaranteed that they could get the degree in the allotted time
right.
that was supposed to happen. The colleges didn't have skin in the game.
Right.
And this happens across the spectrum of life.
And you hear that.
That the institutions that used to keep us safe and used to allow us to rise up aren't working.
Well,
Veterans Administration, these things.
Let's talk about that, because to me, I think people misread anger. I think it's a great catch-all term to sort of describe the Trump phenomenon and even the Cruz phenomenon as anger alone. I think it has a lot more, and I agree with you. I love going out in the country talking with people. I think it has more to do with confusion and disorientation. People don't... This is not the country that they... That things are moving very rapidly.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, is that kind of what you're seeing? Do you agree with that?
Angst. Anxiousness
yeah.
about the future, that it's not working. Some people are angry because they think it's working for some at their expense.
Right.
Town hall meeting yesterday at Joy Manufacturing, a woman got up and said, I have $16,000 of child support due me.
Right.
And my ex-husband, who abused me and my child, has not made the first payment. I went to the Department of Revenue in the state of New Hampshire, and they told me that it was my fault. The crowd just kind of goes like that. So I told the story of how I gave out my email when I was a governor. I would get all sorts of incoming email from moms, just like this woman. And it sensitized me, the fact that we had a broken system of child support. I created a concierge service for people like her.
Right.
Karen Kellums went after these guys like nobody's business, got the money, did whatever they could, enforced the laws, and we also learned to make the laws more more supportive. And I learned through just being, you know, more servant-oriented, that we needed to change our technology. Fast forward 8 years, we increased child support payments by 90%. To me, I'd rather tell that story and talk about that.
Casework, totally lost art in even congressional governance. My first job in life was working for a local congressman who had an office above my parents' ice cream store doing constituent casework.
Yeah.
It used to be a fundamental thing. You know, politicians, congressional offices don't do that anymore. They don't view that as their function.
They should. They should, because, and they should demand in their legislative oversight capacities that the government get off its butt, move into the 21st century, and be supportive of the people that are deserving of the support based on the laws that are passed. So,
but
these
also
are all validations of what I believe that we need to do in Washington.
Do you miss, I know riding around on a bus and going to these places is fun, and debates maybe not so much fun. It sounds to me like you have a real Jones for governing, man. Like you want to get back in there and just do stuff.
No, because I can do it.
Is that frustrating, having to go through this a process which seems to be off the rails? Just want to kind of get your hands on this.
No.
These problems.
No, this is part of the process of leadership. If you can't walk on the hot coals and weather whatever the storms are, you're probably not deserving of being president. It's not to say that people can manipulate this process and end up not being a good leader.
Right.
But the best way to do it is to do it.
But don't you think the process, and the debates, I guess, are just one example of this. Is it ever possible that the process itself becomes so ludicrous it becomes incapable of selecting the right person? I mean, people have made that argument about the Republican Party right now. They made it about the Democratic Party in 72, for instance, right?
Yeah.
But isn't it possible that your party right now is in such a state of transition that it might not be capable of making the appropriate decision?
Well, if it's in transition, it's in transition to something. And my intention is for it to be in transition to something that allows people to rise up again. That's my mission. The greatest joy I have, I mean, you hit on it, it's not to govern, it's to serve. It's to see something that's broken and apply conservative principles to tear down whatever existed and build up something else that allows people to rise up. And that's that potential, which is there, is what we ought to be about. And that's my fight. That's what I'm fighting for. And I don't really, you know, all the stuff that swirls around it is not really relevant to me.
I don't want to compare you to Obama, because I know you don't want that. That's not going to do you any good. But he said something really similar to me, which is sort of about how the swirl around is not necessarily helpful for the solving of these problems. And what I asked him was, how do we get from this place of hyperpartisanship and this sort of, you know, brush fire reality TV populism to a place back where we can actually frame compromise and govern again? So I ask you the same question. How do we get from where we are right now, apart from having faith in the system, and I think we all do, how practically do you convince people to move back to that?
The next president has that unique responsibility more than anybody else, and it's to assume that people that don't agree with you in a fractured society aren't bad people, they just have a different view.
Right.
It might be the wrong view, but you know, stop ascribing bad motives to people that disagree with you. And the president, you know, is culpable in this. When the Iranian agreement was negotiated
right.
and then presented to Congress, not as a treaty, which would have made it impossible for it to pass, but basically a vote that wouldn't be a vote. It was a
right.
It was a chess game for no one to be
right.
actually held accountable. He called
people which the Congress was complicit in because they didn't want to vote. Yeah, most of those guys didn't want to vote on it either.
Yeah, I think it was a missed opportunity and to put people on record. But in this case, the president called people that didn't agree with him in cahoots with the Death to America crowd. Well, I could have made the case that he's in cahoots with the Death to America crowd. He negotiated with them.
Right.
The people that he negotiated with are the ones that 3 days after the agreement was signed did what they always do on the religious days. They march in Tehran and they say death to Israel and death to America. Well, how are you going to forge consensus if you just assume that? I mean, that's pretty outrageous.
Right.
So I think the first thing is you've got to rebuild trust that people in a fractured society with different views, that people with different views aren't necessarily bad.
Well, let's also talk about your party, because your brother was the last president. You know, it was really funny. I covered the 04 election, and I was in New York at the time, so I covered the convention. The one thing that was a really unifying characteristic was, and perhaps it was because we were in a conflict, a hot conflict at that point in time, was that Republican voters would gather around the Republican flag. That seemed to be axiomatic for a period of time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That has changed. To what extent do you think, just, you know, and Sally and your staff participated in that reassessment after the 2012 race. Diagnose for me what the Republican Party looks like right now, and what do you think is going to come out of all this?
We are fractured ideologically. We're fractured in terms of tone. We're no different than the Democrats. It's the political system that is cracking up. I don't know what the form that it takes going forward. Here are the unifying things that could happen. The desire to win. We're in this fight right now where everybody's, you know, fighting. It's what they call it, a primary.
Right.
And lots of people. So it's not just five people, it's 13 or whatever still fighting it out. So at some point we have a nominee, and there will be unity around that nominee, because I think Republicans in all of our hyphenated forms, conservatives want to win, because we can talk about this all we want, but if we don't govern, then we're just going to talk about it. So that's one unifying element that I think is important. And I think the surviving candidates, as you get closer to the point where it starts to matter a lot, I think there's going to be a need to focus back to the point of rhetoric and how you say things. I think there needs to be some discipline.
But that cat seems to be out of the bag, right?
You haven't heard me say that, you know, all Hispanics are rapists or whatever, whatever Trump says, he backs away from it. But the signals that people say go out to a broad audience. And I think avoiding that would be helpful, for example.
Not just helpful, moral.
Yeah, helpful to win. I'm talking about now, how do we organize ourselves to win? You don't insult your way to the White House.
But here's a tough question. You have said before that you would support whoever the nominee is. I totally understand that. But
I signed a pledge.
How could you actually support a guy like Trump if he's the nominee? I understand you have a certain party loyalty, but how would you
to your point, Glenn, I'm the only guy that has consistently gone after him. Everybody else has avoided him. It's God forbid you meet the wrath of Donald Trump as, you know, have a tweet storm coming at you. Well, I'm a big boy. I can handle it.
Right.
And so should everybody else if you're standing on principle and believing in the conservative cause.
And you think the party should get...
I think we should
all get together and just call them out on this stuff.
Yeah, I do. And I think the conservative party ought to have a conservative nominee. And that certainly is called into question when Donald Trump's most of his views within, you know, a relatively decent short time ago were Hillary Clinton's views, or even more. I mean, the last tax policy he had before the one he laid out as a candidate was taxing assets at 14.5%. It's pretty... Sanders hadn't even come up with that. So,
do you think this Iowa, the Iowa second place thing, and the fact that he whined a little bit about it, takes a little of the wind out of the sails?
Yeah, a little bit. I, to his credit, I thought he showed more humility than he has on the election night, and was gracious to the Iowans, and gracious that he didn't win. But then that lasted less than 24 hours, and he got back in his game, you know, and all this stuff about. I didn't, you know, recounts and stuff. I mean, come on.
Well, you mentioned, well, Cruz went after him, and
Cruz is now going after him.
Marco has not, right?
No.
Tell me a little bit about that. Why do you think Marco has not?
Well, it's all a tactic. It's all a tactic for him, and I think principle matters. And one of the principles that a conservative should always embrace is a hopeful, optimistic message that where everybody is included in our, you know, the chance to rise up. That's what we believe when we're successful. At least that's what I believe. And Trump has this view that people are idiots, or POWs aren't heroes because they got caught, or, you know, mocking the disabled, disparaging women. A conservative is never going to win that way. No one should be for that, irrespective of ideology, but...
You did call him out early on it, and I'm sorry I keep returning to Rubio, but we are in a primary battle,
yeah.
And that is a significant issue here. I mean, do you think it showed a lack of courage on Rubio's part to not call him out on that?
You're confronted with this. I have no clue if this helps me or hurts me.
Right.
Standing on principle and confronting the ugly rhetoric of a candidate. I'm not going to spend any money focus grouping that.
Right.
I don't have to.
Right.
It's wrong. Forget, everything else doesn't matter. It's wrong to begin with.
Right.
And and I think Marco's taken a different approach is let Jeb go do it. You know, I don't know what his thinking is, but he hasn't confronted the reality that's not a conservative that's going to win. And that's not the philosophy that I have spent my adult lifetime advocating and having a chance to implement when I was governor of the state of Florida.
You've known him for a while, and you two had a very good relationship.
Yeah, and he's a true conservative. I mean...
But the character question that you're bringing up now, I mean, and as you said before, this is a process that tests the mettle, right?
Yeah.
When you were closer to him back in Florida, did you feel that he had that character? And has your assessment of his character as a politician, not as a person, changed?
His character had never been tested. I've always thought he was gifted. He is charismatic. He lights up a room.
Right.
He has an extraordinary message to tell. All of which is something to be admired.
Right.
The question of confronting, you know, a challenge and sticking with it and having a backbone, if you will, he's never been challenged in his life in that regard. He's young, you know, I mean...
He tells us he's young.
Yeah, no, but that's an advantage, but in one particular place it's not an advantage. If you haven't been... At least in my experience, and I think most people would agree with this, you learn more when you have adversity, when you've been pushed down, when in your life you have sorrow or challenges or, you know, things that don't go the way you want.
Right.
When I lost in 1994 as a candidate, it helped me immensely.
How so?
It gave me humility, for starters. I learned to listen to people. I put a human context around the things that I believed. I learned that I could have won. Now, it's not that it matters, but it was a tough election in that the guy that beat me used tactics that back then were considered atrocious.
Right.
So I spent 6 months where people were saying, oh man, it's unfair and all this stuff. And after about a week, I realized I could have won. But him, it was me. That's what you learn.
Really?
Yeah.
What, that you weren't mean enough?
No, I didn't. When you get attacked and people don't know you,
right,
there's some degree of believability.
Right.
That's why negative campaigning works.
Right.
But if you get attacked and people shrug their shoulders because they say, I know that guy. He's not that person.
It doesn't work.
That's just politics. It doesn't
work.
So
your point is you didn't let people know you well enough.
Yeah. It was a great life lesson. It made me a better leader. That's all I'm saying.
See, I never know how... I have to say the one thing, I've covered politicians for 20 years. Putting yourself out there, I don't think reporters have enough respect for how difficult that is personally. Because it's, you know, there's... It's not a slight rejection. When you get beaten, and it hurts. You know, it's like...
Yeah, and it was the best campaign I ever had. It was... I have friends that are up here going door-to-door from the 94 campaign. I've got a Jeb alumni that would kill for me, and I'd kill for them. The reason they kill for me is they know that I have their back for the rest of their lives. That's just That's what you learn in life. And I think it's important to have a president that has gone through some challenges. And Marco, as gifted as he is, hasn't had to make a tough choice. The one time he did, which I admired, was the getting involved in something that was quite controversial.
The immigration stuff.
Yeah. And he was the catalyst to getting the Senate to pass that bill. Now, was the bill perfect? No. Is any bill perfect?
Right.
It's called democracy. It's the way it's supposed to work.
But he stepped back from the precipice on that as well.
He took heat, and he backed away. And when he backed away, the House backed away.
And you saw that same pattern in the way that he dealt with the Trump phenomenon.
That could be more tactical
than necessary.
That's politics. The immigration deal was, he made a decision, my personal ambition trumps doing my job, in essence, which he was the catalyst to get done. So do you want someone whose natural tendency is to pursue ambition, or do you want someone who runs to the fire? This is the story, you know. I'm not comfortable saying this in the sense that I don't want to attack Marco.
Sure.
But it's just, we have different life experiences. And it's why governors have an advantage in this regard, because governors have to make decisions.
Now, Cruz, do you... Cruz,
same thing.
Same thing, in terms of the showing the character early on, letting you kind of lead.
Well, you mean on Trump.
Well, you were a little bit of a human shield, weren't you, at the third beginning?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, again, I did it... It wasn't, to me, it wasn't a tactic, or it was not designed. I don't have a bunch of people that advise me on this stuff.
Right.
I was offended. I still am. Because the philosophy that I believe in is a compassionate, optimistic philosophy. It's in effect, it's at the core of our nation's success is, you know, the constitutional principle of limited government,
right,
and protecting our protecting ourselves from our government, but there's an assumption of being self-governing and making sure that everybody has a chance to rise up.
But is it possible? And I know I keep going back to this because this is what I'm witnessing from the outside of this, and you're on the inside of this, which is a totally different experience. Isn't it possible that set of imperatives to govern responsibly and the political climate that you're operating in your party right now, are at the moment incompatible? That those are two things that cannot be reconciled? Just as a mistake of history, almost.
We'll find out starting on Tuesday.
Would 2012 have been a... have you ever thought back and thought that 2012 might have been a better year?
No, because I thought about running for president in 2011, and it wasn't right for me at the time. Another part of having a full life is that when you make a decision, you can move on without regret.
What I want to talk about a little bit is your brother. Who's
Neil, Marvin, or George? I got three great brothers.
Well, I only have enough time for one, so I think we'll go with Neil. No.
He's up here.
Really?
Going door to door.
George. One of my favorite books about the presidency recently, I don't know if you share that view, I don't know if you've read the book, is my friend Peter Baker's book on on really the second half of your brother's presidency. And to distill it down to one idea, it is that your brother learned how to be president, that there was a distinct learning curve, that he had his difficulties, he made his mistakes, and the second half of his presidency, particularly the final 2 years, were competent, well-administered, and to a certain extent, wise. Having watched, you know, a lot of people have asked you a lot of questions about your brother in the political context. Having watched him be president and communicated with him over that period of time, what did you learn about the presidency?
Well, first of all, the principal thing I learned about the presidency was that whatever we're talking about today, plans to deal with ISIS, all the policy issues that are important to people, there's going to be something, likely to be earlier rather than later, that will change the whole context of one's presidency. Just the way it is. And so this leadership question really matters, because the next president will be tested in a way that no one knows right now. And you can't plan for that. You have to be prepared for it. And I think that's a lesson that I learned from George, because from a, you know, 9/11 changed his whole presidency completely. And it was not planned for, no one anticipated it, and how he dealt with it, I think, I haven't read Peter Baker's book, but I assume that you learn.
And he talks about the mistakes that he made in delegating too much to Cheney, and how he, to some extent at the end, unlearned those mistakes.
Yeah, so you do learn. I mean, I'm not surprised that that's the case. I would say the last part of my brother's time, the part I didn't like, was that they just let the incoming come.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I got tired of that. Tired because I love my brother, and my impulse watching the news in the last 3 years where no one seemed to defend him was, get out there and fight. Hit back. These guys are wrong. And
how angry did you get when you were watching that stuff?
Bugged the crap out of me, because I think George deserved better, and I just don't think that they, I think, I don't know, just didn't seem like there was a more robust defense of his presidency in the end, and I think you need to do that.
Can I make an observation and tell me if I'm if I'm out of line to say it, but. You know, you just banged your hand when you said that. There's a real vehemence in that defense. Do you think you have, to some extent, defended him more than you've defended yourself sometimes in this process?
I don't know. I do it because I love him, and I've always defended him. When he was president, I never was critical of anything he did, even though there were times that I thought he made the wrong decision. That's what brothers do. Well, I defend myself pretty good, but
you do. I'm not implying you don't, but I mean
that's a little too deep. Now we're getting into the psychobabble.
Well, that's
stuff.
Me. You know, I'm from Brooklyn. One last thing. He obviously went through a hell of an experience. There's nobody on the planet who's gone through what he has gone through, right?
Yeah. He also was the last Republican to win twice.
That's right.
Since Reagan.
As you're going through this trial, and it is a trial.
Yeah.
What has he said to you? What kind of advice has he given you?
His advice is consistently stay the course, be patient, it's coming your way.
And you think that will happen at this point in time?
I feel good about where we are here. I'm in it for the long haul. I don't feel the need to step aside at a time of a dangerous time where I have proven leadership skills. I just don't feel compelled to do it. And I think we're going to surprise people here. We have a great organization in South Carolina, and his point is, stay the course, man.
And this argument that people have made, the Rubio people that staying in...
The Rubio people have made an argument that I came in third. Everybody else must leave. It's like, think about it.
You're not buying that at all. That
No, I'm not buying it. Why should I?
Yeah, I'm not...
You know, it's like, come on. You get a bronze. You get a little red ribbon, and you're everybody else is supposed to just, the waters are supposed to part. Here's the deal. Yeah. Just to remind everybody that's listening, there's going to be a general election, and the Republican nominee, probably 3 weeks, a month before that actually happens, will start getting twitches, because the Clinton hit machine will start hitting them before they even know it.
Yep.
And they're going to get the bark scraped off of them. And anything that goes on between now and then that toughens up the nominee, and I hope it to be me, will only make it easier to deal with what the incoming is going to be. It will pale by comparison to the little stuff that's going on right now.
One last thing as we pull up to your event.
So Marco doesn't need any protection. I don't need any protection. Everybody needs to man up.
By the way, that's a great mic drop, but I gotta ask you one last thing. Everybody who's ever worked for you said that you were one of the most competitive people they have ever met. Do you think people really appreciate that?
The people that know me do, yeah. I can outwork people. I'm a grinder. I show dogged determination each and every day. I do this in a way that isn't... I mean, competitive can be exhibited lots of different ways, but I'm pretty competitive.
How does it manifest itself outside of politics?
Outside of politics, on the golf course when I used to play golf, it's...
And you don't cheat?
No, I don't cheat. I don't cheat. No comment about who does. No, I don't cheat. But just in nature, just in terms of work ethic, in terms of doing the extra thing, you know, building the business we built, just outworking people. You get opportunities by work. It's an incredible virtue.
Well, Governor, on that note, I very much appreciate you taking
Thanks.
The time.
Thanks, good timing. We made it to Concord without an accident on the highway, and it looks like it stopped snowing.
Well, I will take that as a successful podcast.